The book was big, okay? The book was major. I was afraid to change rooms, let alone pack up the typewriter in my slim, just-begun manuscript and take it back to Derry. That would be as dangerous as taking an infant out into a windstorm. So I stayed, always reserving the right to move out if things got too weird, the way smokers reserve the right to quit if their coughs get too heavy. And a week passed. Things happened during that week, but until I met Max DeVore on the street the following Friday, the 17th of July it would have been, the most important thing was that I continued to work on a novel which would, if finished, be called My Childhood Friend. Perhaps we always think what was lost was the best, or would have been the best. I don't know for sure. What I do know is that my real life that week had mostly to do with Andy Drake, John Shackelford, and a shadowy figure standing in the deep background, Raymond Garrity, John Shackelford's childhood friend, a man who sometimes wore a baseball cap. During that week, the manifestations in the house continued, but at a lower level, there was nothing like that blood-curdling scream. Sometimes Bunter's bell rang. Sometimes the fruit and vegetable magnets would reform themselves into a circle. Never with words in the middle, though, not that week. One morning I got up and the sugar canister was overturned, making me think of Maddie's story about the flower. Nothing was written in the spill, but there was a squiggle, as though something had tried to write and failed. If so, I sympathized. I knew what that was like. My depot before the redoubtable Elmer Durgan was on Friday the 14th. On the following Tuesday, I took the street down to Warrington's softball field, hoping for my own peek at Max DeVore. It was going on 6 o'clock when I got within hearing range of the shouts, cheers, and batted balls. A path marked with rustic signs, curlicued W's burned into oak arrows, led past the abandoned boathouse, a couple of sheds, and a gazebo half-buried in blackberry creepers. I eventually came out in deep center field. A litter of potato chip bags, candy wrappers, and beer cans suggested that others sometimes watched the games from this vantage point. I couldn't help thinking about Joe and her mysterious friend, the guy in the old brown sport coat, the burly guy who had slipped an arm around her waist and led her away from the game, laughing, back toward the street. Twice over the weekend, I'd come close to calling Bonnie Mudson, seeing if maybe I could chase that guy down, put a name on him, and both times I had backed off. Sleeping dogs, I told myself each time. Sleeping dogs, Michael. I had the area beyond deep center to myself that evening, and it felt like the right distance from home plate, considering the man who usually parked his wheelchair behind the backstop had called me a liar, and I had invited him to store my telephone number where the sunshine grows dim. I needn't have worried in any case. DeVore wasn't in attendance, nor was the lovely Roguette. I did spot Maddie behind the casually maintained chicken wire barrier on the first baseline. John Starrow was beside her, wearing jeans and a polo shirt, his red hair mostly corralled by a Mets cap. They stood watching the game and chatting like old friends for 2 innings before they saw me. More than enough time for me to feel envious of John's position, and a little jealous as well. Finally, someone lofted a long fly to center, where the edge of the woods served as the only fence. The center fielder backed up, but it was going to be far over his head. It was hit to my depth, off to my right. I moved in that direction without thinking, high-footing through the shrubs that formed a zone between the mown outfield and the trees, hoping I wasn't running through poison ivy. I caught the softball in my outstretched left hand and laughed when some of the spectators cheered. The center fielder applauded me by tapping his bare right hand into the pocket of his glove. The batter, meanwhile, circled the bases serenely, knowing he had hit a ground-rule home run. I tossed the ball to the fielder, and as I returned to my original post among the candy wrappers and beer cans, I looked back in and saw Maddie and John looking at me. If anything confirms the idea that we're just one more species of animal, one with a slightly bigger brain and a much bigger idea of our own importance in the scheme of things, it's how much we can convey by gesture when we absolutely have to. Maddie clasped her hands to her chest, tilted her head to the left, raised her eyebrows. My hero. I held my hands to my shoulders and flipped the palms skyward. Shucks, ma'am, 'twarn't nothing. John lowered his head and put his fingers to his brow as if something there hurt. You lucky son of a bitch. With those comments out of the way, I pointed at the backstop and shrugged a question. Both Maddie and John shrugged back. An inning later, a little boy who looked like one giant exploding freckle ran out to where I was, his oversized Michael Jordan jersey churning around his shins like a dress. Guy down there give me 50 cents to say you should call him later on at his hotel over in the Rock, he said, pointing at John. He say you give me another 50 cents if there was an answer. Tell him I'll call him around 9:30, I said. I don't have any change, though. Can you take a buck? Hey, yeah, swank. He snatched it, turned away, then turned back. He grinned, revealing a set of teeth caught between Act One and Act Two. With the softball players in the background, he looked like a Norman Rockwell archetype. Guy also say to tell you that was a bullshit catch. Tell him people used to say the same thing about Willie Mays all the time. Willie who? Ah, youth. Ah, Maurice. Just tell him, son, he'll know. I stayed another inning, but by then the game was getting drunk, divorce still hadn't shown, and I went back home the way I had come. I met one fisherman standing out on a rock and two young people strolling along the street toward Warrington's, their hands linked. They said hi, and I hied them back. I felt lonely and content at the same time. I believe that is a rare kind of happiness. Some people check their phone answering machines when they get home. That summer, I always checked the front of the fridge. Eeny, meeny, chilly, beanie, as Bullwinkle Moose used to say, the spirits are about to speak. That night they hadn't, although the fruit and vegetable magnets had reformed into a sinuous shape like a snake or perhaps the letter S taking a nap. A little later, I called John and asked him where DeVore had been, and he repeated in words what he had already told me, and much more economically by gesture. It's the first game he's missed since he came back, he said. Maddie tried asking a few people if he was okay, and the consensus seemed to be that he was, at least as far as anyone knew. What do you mean she tried asking a few people? I mean that several wouldn't even talk to her. Cut her dead, my parents' generation would have said. Watch it, buddy, I thought, but didn't say. That's only half a step from my generation. One of her old girlfriends spoke to her finally, but there's a general attitude about Maddie DeVore. That man Osgood may be a shitty realtor, but as DeVore's Mr. Money Guy, he's doing a wonderful job of separating Maddie from the other folks in the town. Is it a town, Mike? I don't quite get that part. It's just the TR, I said absently. There's no real way to explain it. Do you really believe DeVore's bribing everyone? That doesn't say much for the good old Wordsworthian idea of pastoral innocence and goodness, does it? He's spreading money and using Osgood, maybe Footman too, to spread stories. And the folks around here seem at least as honest politicians. The ones who stay bought? Yeah. Oh, and I saw one of DeVore's potential star witnesses in the case of the runaway child, Royce Merrill. He was over by the equipment shed with some of his cronies. Did you happen to notice him? I said I had not. Guy must be 130, John said. He's got a cane with a gold head the size of an elephant's asshole. That's a Boston Post cane. The oldest person in the area gets to keep it. And I have no doubt he came by it honestly. If DeVore's lawyers put him on the stand, I'll debone him. There was something chilling in John's gleeful confidence. I'm sure, I said. How did Maddie take getting cut dead by her old friends? I was thinking of her saying that she hated Tuesday nights, hated to think of the softball games going on as they always had at the field where she had met her late husband. She did okay, John said. I think she's given most of them up as a lost cause anyway. I had my doubts about that. I seemed to remember that at 20, lost causes are sort of a specialty. but I didn't say anything. She's hanging in. She's been lonely and scared. I think that in her own mind, she might already have begun the process of giving Kyra up. But she's got her confidence back now, mostly thanks to meeting you. Talk about your fantastically lucky breaks. Well, maybe. I flashed on Joe's brother Frank, once saying to me that he didn't think there was any such thing as luck, only fate and inspired choices. And then I remembered that image of the TR crisscrossed with invisible cables, connections that were unseen but as strong as steel. John, I forgot to ask the most important question of all the other day after I gave my depot. This custody case we're all so concerned about, has it even been scheduled? Good question. I've checked three ways to Sunday, and Bissonette has too. Unless DeVore and his people have pulled something really slippery, like filing in another court district, I don't think it has been. Could they do that? File in another district? Maybe, but probably not without us finding out. So what does it mean? That DeVore's on the verge of giving up, John said promptly. As of now, I see no other way of explaining it. I'm going back to New York first thing tomorrow, but I'll stay in touch. If anything comes up here, you do the same. I said I would and went to bed. No female visitors came to share my dreams. That was sort of a relief. When I came downstairs to recharge my iced tea glass late Wednesday morning, Brenda Meserve had erected the laundry whirligig on the back stoop and was hanging out my clothes. This she did, as her mother had no doubt taught her, with pants and shirts on the outside and undies on the inside, where any passing nosy parkers couldn't see what you chose to wear closest to your skin. "You can take these in around 4 o'clock," Mrs. M. said as she prepared to leave. She looked at me with the bright and cynical eye of a woman who has been doing for well-off men her entire life. "Don't you forget and leave them out all night. Dewy clothes don't ever feel fresh until they're washed again." I told her most humbly that I would remember to take in my clothes. I then asked her, feeling like a spy working an embassy party for information, if the house felt all right to her. "All right how?" she asked, cocking one wild eyebrow at me. "Well, I've heard funny noises a couple of times in the night." She sniffed. "It's a log house, ain't it? Built in relays, so to speak. It settles one wing against t'other. That's what you hear, most likely." "No ghosts, huh?" I said, as if disappointed. "Not that I've ever seen," she said, as matter-of-fact as an accountant. "But my ma said there's plenty down here. She said this whole lake is haunted. By the Micmacs that lived here until they were driven out by General Wing, by all the men who went away to the Civil War and died there. Over 600 went from this part of the world, Mr. Noonan, and less than 150 came back, at least, in their bodies. Ma said this side of Dark Score is also haunted by the ghost of that Negro boy who died here, poor tyke. He belonged to one of the Red Tops, you know." "No, I know about Sarah and the Red Tops, but not this." I paused. "Did he drown?" "Nope, caught in an animal trap. Struggled there for most of a whole day, screaming for help. Finally, they found him. They saved the foot, but they shouldn't have. Blood poisoning set in, and the boy died. Summer of '01, that was. It's why they left, I guess. It was too sad to stay. But my ma used to claim the little fella. He stayed. She used to say that he's still on the TR. I wondered what Mrs. M. would say if I told her that the little fella had very likely been here to greet me when I arrived from Derry and had been back on several occasions since. "Then there was Kenny Oster's father, Normal," she said. "You know that story, don't you?" "Oh, that's a terrible story." She looked rather pleased, either at knowing such a terrible story or at having the chance to tell it. "No," I said. "I know Kenny, though. He's the one with the wolfhound, Blueberry." "Yeah, he carpenters a tad and caretakes a tad, just like his father before him. His dad caretook many of these places, you know, and back just after the Second World War was over, Normal Oster drowned Kenny's little brother in his backyard." This was when they lived on Wasp Hill, down where the road splits, one side going to the old boat landing and the other to the marina. He didn't drown the tyke in the lake, though. He put him on the ground under the pump and just held him there until the baby was full of water and dead. I stood there looking at her, the clothes behind us snapping on their whirligig. I thought of my mouth and nose and throat full of that cold mineral taste that could have been well water as well as lake water. Down here, all of it comes from the same deep aquifers. I thought of the message on the refrigerator. Help, I'm drowned. He left the baby laying right under the pump. He had a new Chevrolet, and he drove it down here to Lane 42. Took his shotgun, too.
You aren't going to tell me Kenny Oster's dad committed suicide in my house, are you, Mrs. Mazur?
She shook her head. Nope. He did it on the Bricker's lakeside deck. Sat down on their porch glider and blew his damn baby-murdering head off.
The Brickers? I don't...
You wouldn't. Hasn't been any Brickers on the lake since the 60s. They were from Delaware. Quality folks. You'd think of it as the Washburn place, I guess, although they're gone now, too. Place is empty. Every now and then that stock, natural-born fool Osgood brings someone down and shows it off, but he'll never sell it at the price he's asking, mark my words.
The Washburns I had known had played bridge with them a time or two. Nice enough people, although probably not what Mrs. M., with her queer backcountry snobbishness, would have called quality. Their place was maybe an eighth of a mile north of mine along the street. Past that point, there's nothing much. The drop to the lake gets steep, and the woods are massed tangles of second growth and blackberry bushes. The street goes on to the tip of Halo Bay at the far north end of Dark Score, but once Lane 42 curves back to the highway, it is for the most part used only by berry-picking expeditions in the summer and hunters in the fall. Normal, I thought. Hell of a name for a guy who had drowned his infant son under the backyard pump. Did he leave a note? Any explanation?
Nope. But you'll hear folks say he haunts the lake, too. Little towns are most likely full of haunts, but I couldn't say I know or maybe myself. I ain't the sensitive type. All I know about your place, Mr. Noonan, is that it smells damp no matter how much I try to get it aired out. I imagine that's logs. Log buildings don't go well with lakes. The damp gets into the wood.
She had set her purse down between her Reeboks. Now she bent and picked it up. It was a countrywoman's purse, black, styleless, except for the gold grommets holding the handles on, and utilitarian. She could have carried a good selection of kitchen appliances in there if she had wanted to.
I can't stand here nattering all day long, though. Much as I might like to, I got one more place to go before I can call it quits. Summer's harvest time in this part of the world, you know. Now remember to take those clothes in before dark, Mr. Noonan. Don't let them get all dewy.
I won't, and I didn't. But when I went back out to take them in, dressed in my bathing suit and coated with sweat from the oven I'd been working in, I had to get the air conditioner fixed, just had to. I saw that something had altered Mrs. M.'s arrangements. My jeans and shirts now hung around the pole. The underwear and socks, which had been decorously hidden when Mrs. M. drove up the driveway in her old Ford, were now on the outside. It was as if my unseen guest, one of my unseen guests, was saying, ha, ha, ha.